Some wildlife rehabilitation centers around the country reported an influx of calls from the public in the early months of the pandemic when people were hunkered down at home. We're talking about the work of caring for wild animals in distress and what is currently known about how the coronavirus spreads in wild animals. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this year, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, put a temporary restriction on the care and rehab of bats. It also applies to bobcats, weasel species, mink, fisher, and otter. Do you work for a wildlife rehab group? What's it been like during the pandemic? How do you feel about the DNR's temporary restrictions? We're at 800-642-1234. Amanda Camps is a wildlife health conservation specialist at the DNR. Mandy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me today.
Good morning. So I'm wondering if you could kind of give us the lay of the land. What are you seeing and hearing from wildlife rehabilitation centers amid the pandemic?
Well, this year has definitely been a challenge for everybody, and certainly for wildlife rehabilitators. Even thinking back to this spring when we had our first safer at home order, wildlife rehabilitators were starting to feel the effects already, as spring is the baby animal season. And that's when a lot of calls come in. A lot of animals are brought into their centers, and they had, a variety of ways to try and work through to protect their own health and safety, and as well as still being able to provide some care to animals. So some facilities did have to temporarily close. Other facilities had some restrictions or limitations on how many animals they could take in for care. And others, were still doing really the best that they could with fewer people helping them out this year. So it was a bit of a change, especially this spring for everybody. And certainly that's continued throughout the summer and into the fall here, as we're still managing or trying to manage to get through even with our own health and safety precautions.
So there are rehabilitators, it looks like, in 26 counties. Are they all still operating at present?
Most of them are still operating. There might be a couple that are still faced with some limitations, and you never know what else is going on in someone's life. And rehabilitators are volunteers. They do this on their own time and expense, and they care for the animals. So they're doing still the best that they can. And even though there are just those counties that you listed that do have rehabilitators in them, rehabilitators certainly will assist with animal situations across other counties as well. They're not just limited to those. So really, we've got some statewide coverage. It's just in certain areas, there's more rehabilitators than in other areas.
Mandy, earlier this year, you put in some temporary restrictions for rehabilitation. Can you explain what guidance you're following from the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies?
Sure, absolutely. So, I guess to start off with is that we have staff in our DNR and with other state agencies and even at the federal level, as you just mentioned, AFLA, and we're all kind of working together to try and get through this. So we're certainly not alone in what we're talking about when it comes to rehabilitation, and also part of the conversation also focus on research and other monitoring activities. So it's not just rehabilitation specific, but with so much unknown information on COVID-19 or, the virus that causes it, when we're talking about animals, it's SARS-CoV-2, there's so much unknown information about that. And a lot of what we're trying to figure out from the beginning has really focused on the human health side of it, of course.
Sure.
We want to know how it affects us. But we certainly want to know how it affects our pets at home, our domestic animals, but then also wild animals too. So I guess we're looking at what we're trying to figure out with the virus. There has been some work done in wild animals, but it hasn't been as much, or we don't know as much yet about it versus what we might know in our human health effects. So
Go ahead.
It's because of the unknowns out there that we are taking some extra precaution measures, like the temporary rehab restrictions. It's one way to minimize or limit the human interaction with our wild animal species that we have in the state. And it's just one thing that we can do to try and help protect those populations of the animals that we have.
Mandy Camps is with us this hour. She works with the DNR as a wildlife health conservation specialist, and we're discussing wildlife rehab and management amid the pandemic. Taking your calls as well, do you work as a rehabilitator? What's it been like during the pandemic? Have you seen an influx or maybe a decrease in animals needing help or in distress? Calls from the public. Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Mandy, specifically with these temporary restrictions, bats is one area that you do not want rehabilitation on right now. Other areas include skunks, beavers, otters. Can you get into more of the specifics of what this restriction covers?
Sure, absolutely. So in the spring, the first restriction that was put into place was on bats. And that was because at least with not North American bat species, but the other bat species, of course, other parts of the world, and thinking of when we were trying to figure out where this virus originated from, it is thought to be from an animal and it is thought to be from a bat. So in order to provide one extra level of protection to our North American bat species, again, we don't know if they're susceptible to it. That's where the restriction was put in place. And again, that was just to limit the possible interaction or close contact with people with bats. And you know, what we know about a person that may have the virus is not everybody shows symptoms or even knows that they're sick. So that's part of the risk there, is that somebody who may not know that they have it could potentially unknowingly transmit it to an animal. And we just don't know if our North American bats are susceptible. So that's the first restriction that was put in place earlier this spring. And then as we started to get more information about the virus in animals, other animals in the U.S. and across the world have tested positive. You know, you may have remember hearing about some tigers at the Bronx Zoo. There's some domestic cats and dogs, some domestic mink. And so as we're learning more about how the virus may affect those animals, is that those are members of our Felidae family, the cat family, the Mustelidae family, or is known as the weasel family. And we have members of those families of wild animals in the state. So knowing that there is a potential risk because of the related species, more of the domestic side or captive wild animals that were at zoos or places like that have tested positive, the restriction on rehab for wild felid and mustelid species was put in place. And again, that was just a measure to help protect our wild populations that we have and hopefully prevent the virus from getting into those wild populations.
DNR Wildlife Health Conservation Specialist Mandy Camps, she is with us. She's our guide as we talk wildlife rehabilitation. What questions do you have about wild animals and the relation to the virus? What about animals in distress? Have you spotted a baby animal needing help? Did you report it? What was the process like? Did you transport the animal? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mandy Camps here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing wildlife management and rehabilitation during the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dealing with distressed wildlife requires caution. Wild animal behavior is unpredictable. I see so many wild animals on my bike ride to work in the dark wee hours of the morning. Rabbits, raccoons, foxes, skunk, on my path. I try to glide by quietly and quickly without causing any comeuppance. What questions do you have about wildlife in your yard or in your community? What do you want to know about wild animals and COVID-19? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Mandy Camps, who is a wildlife health conservation specialist with the DNR, and she stays with us. Mandy, I want you to give us an update on what we know about mink in particular, because earlier this month there was the outbreak of infection at a mink farm in the Medford area, and we've also learned out of Utah thousands of mink have died at farms there. What do we know about the susceptibility of mink to the virus?
Well, I think what we know, even from these mink farms where quite a few animals have tested positive with the virus, is that they are susceptible to it. It is one of the, they are part of that mustelid family, that weasel family, and that at least some of the information we know so far is that they do seem to be more susceptible to the virus, maybe than other animals are. But at the same time, we're still learning more about the virus and how it affects animals and how it can be transmitted between animals, and we're just still learning a lot about it.
Did the people who own or work on this mink farm test positive for COVID?
Well, DNR does not have authority over mink farms.
Okay.
We don't regulate them, and yeah. I really don't know the specifics on that case.
Yeah, and so it's still very much unclear if COVID is spreading from infected people to farm animals. We just don't know that.
Right. There's just a lot that's unknown when it comes to either even the domestic or the farm animals or the captive wild animals. There's just a lot that's unknown when it comes to animals, or at least our North American animals, the ones that we're used to seeing around here. There's just still a lot that's unknown. And part of that unknown is what I mentioned a little bit earlier, too, is that, you know, if a person has the virus, they may not know they do, and they could potentially be transmitting it to animals. And this is just one area where we need to get more information on. We need to know what's possible and what animals might be more susceptible than others.
We're talking with Mandy Camps. She is a wildlife health conservation specialist with the DNR. We're looking at wildlife rehab and management amid the pandemic and taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Mandy, a really practical question here. What happens if you have a bat in your house? What options can you do to be able to take care of that?
Sure. And those might get a few calls this time of year with bats in the house. Some of our bat species are looking to hibernate for the winter, so they might be in more of an interaction in an attic or someplace like that. And, you know, it's still important to find ways to protect our bats in the state. Some of the species that you're most likely probably to come in contact with are the little brown or big brown bats, and those are you know, they're threatened. They need extra protection in the state because of other issues that they're faced with. So, you know, we do have guidance on our DNR website on bats and how to handle interactions with them. If somebody does find a bat in their house, they can, there's individuals that can be brought in that are licensed that can get them out of the house. There's even some other people that could come in to help with that. But you can install like exclusion devices that encourage the bat to leave. It can get out, but it can't get back in. And really, if a bat's in a house, to try and minimize the amount of interaction with a person and also with your domestic pets. If there's a way to, you know, safely get them out of the house, you can try that. You can contact us for advice on doing that. And we even have a page with a few very common questions, just like this one. What do I do if a bat's in my house or if I find a bat in the attic? And really can go to this page just to get more details on how to handle those situations.
And is it vary from one situation to the next on what practical steps that you can take if you are in this situation?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, every situation is different, but regardless, I mean, people should be protecting their own safety when handling bats. There is another health risk with bats with the rabies virus. So there's an extra precaution regardless of what type of situation you have.
Why is it important to protect bats?
Well, bats are some of our species that they really do have a vital part of ecosystems. Mm. They're pollinators, they're seed dispersers for many plants. They consume a lot of agricultural and forest pests, and you know, especially the biting insects that none of us like. you know, so they do play a very important role in these ecosystems, and it is just very important that we can do what we can to help protect our populations.
So going back to the other temporary restrictions around, you know, rehapping the mustelid, the skunk, the beavers, the otters, the badgers, is it common for wildlife rehabilitators to come in contact with these animals and work on some type of rehab?
Well, I'll say that members of our mustelid family, the weasel family, and you have mentioned some of those species that we have in the state, they're not one of the more common admits to rehabilitation centers. It's not one of the animals that people come in contact with potentially the most.
Okay.
So there are some, certainly, that are admitted every year. You know, some in the spring, some young animals, and then others that may have an injury that need some care that come in throughout the year. But, you know, and with any of these species, but others as well, is that not every animal that's brought into a rehabilitation center can be rehabilitated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be a serious injury or a significant health risk or something where it just would make that animal not able to recover enough to have that successful release back into the environment, so that, you know, the whole goal of wildlife rehabilitation is to provide the temporary care to animals so that they can be released again and be successful in surviving once they're released.
Well, let's bring in Pam now, who's joining us in the North Woods. Pam, hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a question about, you know, up in the North Woods right now, we have a lot of wolves. And I know they have been, like, attacking domestic. First, that was separated in a pasture. And the wolf did attack it, but we caught it, and the wolves ran off. And I actually put a tourniquet on the horse because it was bleeding everywhere.
Mm.
And I got the blood all over me, and I'm sure the wolf blood would have been in that cut, right? And when the vet came, the horse did die because it was bleeding so much. And so they tested it for rabies. And I was really scared, but it was negative for rabies. But they didn't test for COVID.
All right. Let's let Mandy jump in here on this situation of a horse being attacked.
Well, you know, for one, I guess I'm very sorry that you had to go through that situation and what happened with your horse. I guess to talk about, you know, why if the wolf was tested for rabies, is that virus itself is one in mammals, and so certainly with more of the carnivore species, if there is a bite or a scratch or some interaction with a person or domestic animal, those are reasons why animals would be submitted for testing for rabies. And then with your question on whether or not the animal was tested for COVID-19, is that there really is not a lot of regular testing at all that's being done in animals, even if it's a domestic animal or a wild animal. There's really only certain situations where that may be the case, and it's not something that's commonly done. Maybe more focused in, you know, a research setting or some other reason with some populations that are at risk.
Is the testing mechanism, would it be the same as humans for animals?
It would be a different type of test.
Okay.
That would be done, but it's just, yeah, it's not one that's commonly done in animals.
Yeah. And so if you have a situation of an attack on an animal, you know, is that something you would call a vet first or a rehab group, or what would happen in a situation like that?
Well, I mean, I guess in this case, you could, since it did involve a wild animal, you could reach out to local DNR contacts that you have.
Yeah.
You know, with the horse being affected, you would want to bring in a veterinarian, just like sounds like that she did here, just to care for the animal. So it's a variety of responses or people that you can contact. If you do find an injured wild animal, I guess those would be the cases where you could reach out to a rehabilitator. But, you know, certainly with some restrictions in place right now, there are some limitations on some animals.
We have the DNR's Mandy Camps with us on wildlife management and rehab. Have you recently applied for a wildlife rehabilitation license? What was the process like? What questions do you have about wild animals in distress? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming. President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden will meet in their final scheduled presidential debate tonight at 8. We'll bring you live NPR coverage. The debate will take place in Nashville at Belmont University. That's live NPR coverage tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about wildlife rehab amid the pandemic. There are licensed wildlife rehabilitators in 26 counties, as we've been talking about. They field calls about sick, injured, orphaned wildlife. There are special deer rehab procedures for the intake, release, and marking of deer to address disease management issues. We'll be talking about that more. What questions do you have about how to help animals in distress? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mandy Camps is a wildlife health conservation specialist with the DNR, and she stays with us. Let's bring in another question now. Jim is joining us from Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm wondering if any of the minks you were talking about were sick or dying, and what kind of test was used? Because Dr. Kerry Mullis, the inventor of the PCR test, said it was not appropriate to use it for medical diagnosis. It would give 80 to 100% false positives. In fact, in Africa, one of the presidents was skeptical of it and tested a goat and a papaya and a fence as a pheasant, and the goat and the papaya, a piece of fruit, tested positive.
All right, so Mandy, can you explain any more that you know about the mink situation and with testing?
Well, I really don't have any information or details about the farm in Wisconsin that tested positive. Again, it's not – the mink farm area is not one that's regulated or the DNR does not have any authority over them. So I really don't have a lot of details to share with specifics about the farm and what type of testing was done.
Let's focus on deer now. There are specific procedures around rehabilitating deer. What can you tell us there?
Sure. So with deer rehabilitation, there are some special precautions and some requirements to follow when it comes to deer. And some rehabilitators are licensed to rehabilitate deer. Not everyone is. And one of the main considerations here is really, again, trying to incorporate some disease management into still having deer rehabilitation an option. And when we talk about deer rehabilitation, it's really focusing on fawns, really young, the young deer, the fawns that are born in May and June and into the spring and early summer. Those are the age of deer where we get calls on if they're orphaned, and even some where somebody might find or come across a fawn and assume it's orphaned, and hopefully we can work them through that situation. But some of the special requirements here are just not transporting fawns a far distance away. And if a fawn is orphaned, it needs to be brought into a rehab center. If that location of where the fawn is in a county that is considered CWD affected, then it needs to go to a rehabilitator in a county that's also CWD affected, and vice versa as well. So we have some counties that are not CWD affected, and any fawns that are found there and need rehab care should stay at a rehab center in a non-affected county.
So what can you tell us about chronic wasting disease? What is the spread look like here in Wisconsin?
Well, again, I guess this is something that we still continue to learn more about. We have some areas of the state where we know the disease is, and it's either has been detected for quite some time already or some of the more recent detections. So one important component here is that the one way that we know where the disease is or where it may not be yet is by hunters and any hunters getting deer tested for CWD, having people send in reports of sick deer to local DNR staff, and really just working on getting the information, the tests done, just so we know where the disease is or is not.
There's also been a concerted effort in recent years about carcass disposal and those sites of carcass disposal. What improvements have been made there?
Okay. Yeah, we have had a few additions in the last couple of years. So with the carcass disposal, we have a program that's called the Adopt a Dumpster Program, and that's where individuals and organizations can sign up to sponsor a dumpster that is designated specifically for deer carcass waste. And they can be available for a variety of time frames and at different locations across the state. And so one suggestion I have for hunters out there as they're getting out this fall and into the winter months is checking a map that we have on one of our DNR web pages that has both the locations to submit a CWD sample and also the locations of where these dumpsters are. And it's just important. It's one way prevent possible disease transmission here as well, is that if carcass waste is disposed of properly and it doesn't remain in the environment, that's one way to reduce the potential for disease transmission from deer to deer.
Do you get good participation from hunters with a CWD testing? Have you watched those trends?
Yeah, definitely. And every year we do get very good participation from hunters. Every year we're looking in some different areas of the state where we may have some other interest to collect more samples, have some enhanced sampling locations, have more of them available for hunters. And every year we just get some great participation by hunters who just want to get their deer tested.
We're talking with Mandy Camps, works with the DNR as a wildlife health conservation specialist. We're discussing wildlife rehab and management amid the pandemic. Taking your questions as well, do you work for a rehabilitation group? What's it been like during the pandemic? Have you seen an increase or decrease in animals needing help? How do you feel about the DNR temporarily limiting rehabilitation to certain species? Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Mandy, with those fawns and helping rehabilitate a fawn, is the goal still to put that deer back into the wild, or can that deer ever be reintroduced?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the goal of rehab for any animal that's brought into care is to bring that animal back to a great condition of health and have it in a case where it can be released again. So with fawns, absolutely, the goal there is to provide that temporary care to them so that they can be released.
So if you see a wild animal and a young animal that seems to not be with its mother or is all on its own, is that the case for the young, or do we act too quickly?
That's another great question. And, you know, thinking of fawns in particular, is that this is one species that I know our DNR staff across the state get a lot of calls on every spring and summer. Rehabilitators also get a lot of calls on, and it's one of those animals where the young, the baby, is often found alone by itself. It may be laying down in the grass or in some strange places, like against a garage or right in the middle of somebody's backyard. And it's just very unique to us. We don't see that as any type of normal behavior or anything that we would do with one of our kids. But wild animals have different natural behaviors. They respond to ways that they can protect their young, their babies. And some of those ways are very different than what we would think. And with a fawn in particular, when the mother will just leave the fawn and it's by itself, again, laying down quiet in the grass or against a building, that's pretty normal behavior for deer. That's absolutely what the mother should do, and the baby knows it's those natural instincts kick in and they lay there quiet and still, and they're doing exactly what they should be doing. It's just sometimes if we come across a fawn like that, we might think it needs help. And in those cases, the best thing to do is just, you know, make note of it, keep your distance, give it some time. If you want to reach out to any DNR staff or a rehabilitator just for some advice, I welcome everyone to do that. It's just important to not assume right away it's orphaned and does need help, because oftentimes it might not, and it just needs some time to be reunited with the mother. Some other animals that do something similar, you know, rabbit nests.
I was about to say that the young rabbits, those tend to, they're left alone in their nest as well.
They are, yeah. In that case, the mother rabbit only comes back twice a day to feed the babies, and that's it. Mm-hmm. The best way for her to protect them from predators and from other threats is to leave them alone, concealed in the nest. So it just, I think it's just important for everybody that we always want to help an animal if we find it, and we may just think it automatically needs help, but oftentimes it doesn't. And just knowing who to call, where to go to get the reliable, the correct information to figure out if an animal needs help is really the best thing to do.
Yeah, take it kind of one step at a time. Don't rush to conclusions that animal actually does need help.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
We have the DNR's Mandy Camps as our guide to wildlife health and management. Have you reported an animal in distress before? What was the process like? Did you need to transport the animal? Where did you take it? What questions do you have about wildlife and the coronavirus? Still time to talk these through. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Mandy Camps from the DNR right here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about wildlife rehabilitation and management with Mandy Camps. She is a wildlife health conservation specialist with the DNR. So when a wild animal is suffering, a wildlife rehab facility may be able to help, but these facilities have felt the effects of COVID. And earlier this year, the Wisconsin DNR put new temporary restrictions around wildlife rehabilitation. So, Mandy, what is the process like to become a licensed wildlife rehabilitator? What does that licensure hold? How does that work?
Sure. So, to apply for a license, there are a few steps that you need to take. It starts off by taking an exam, taking and passing an exam, I should say. And then there's some forms to fill out about a license application, getting a consulting veterinarian to assist you, and also having a sponsor who is a currently advanced licensed wildlife rehabilitator to sign up to sponsor you, or you by being the applicant for the license for at least the first couple of years while you're licensed. And then filling out and sending in a variety of facility protocols on things like disposal and cleaning and disinfecting, you know, work with your veterinarian on pharmaceuticals and, you know, really focusing on disease prevention as well. And then the last part of the application process is having a what we call facility inspection. So I always call the location where the rehabilitator is a facility. It could be at an actual a separate location from their house. You know, it could be at an existing facility already, or it even could be at somebody's home. And having an inspection done just to make sure that other minimum requirements are met. And if everything looks good, then I can go ahead and issue a license.
When will you take a look at the restrictions that are temporarily in place? When will you reexamine those restrictions around bats and the skunks and the beavers, badgers, otters, and those groups?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one note that I'll make about skunks in particular is that, yes, they are a member of our weasel family, our mustelids in the state, but we actually do have a separate restriction on the rehab of skunks because of the one of the viruses, rabies viruses, that's most prevalent in the state is the skunk strain. So, so yeah, there is a little bit of a difference with skunks here, but other mustelid species do have that temporary restriction in place. And all along, we are staying up to date on the information that we know or that we're learning about the virus and how it can affect wild animals. We're part of conversations with other state agencies and federal agencies and just keeping that thumb on the pulse of what information we know. And so as we're continuing with that, if there's you know, changes to be made to that temporary restriction based on the information, the new information that we know, we certainly could make those.
You have this initiative called Keep Wildlife Wild. Can you explain the effort there?
Oh, yeah. Yep. So with Keep Wildlife Wild, it just started with a bigger focus, I should say. This started back in 2014, and we wanted to have ways and get information out to folks about explaining the natural behaviors of animals. You know, like we just talked about with the fawns and the rabbits, what's normal behavior for them, and get that information out to people of all ages in ways where they can, you know, understand a little bit more about animals, understand the normal behaviors, or understand when an animal might need help. And then also incorporating all the reasons why we like to keep those wild animals in their natural environments. You know, they really don't belong in captivity long-term. I mean, certainly rehab does bring them into a captive facility temporarily for a reason, but the rehab of animals is very different than keeping a wild animal in captivity. So we wanted to get the information out to students, to adults, to a variety of different audiences. And, you know, one of our favorite actions, I guess, that we do with this initiative is that we'll kind of a little bit of a lead in here to our third annual poster contest for 4th through 6th grade students. And so I just encourage anybody listening or if anybody wants to share in a class that it'll be announced here in the near future and we can, you know, get some entries from students. And really it brings them in and gives them an activity where they can learn about wild animals and the reasons why it's important to keep them wild.
Mandy, thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me this morning.
Mandy Camps is a wildlife health conservation specialist with the DNR. Well, Wisconsin's presidential primary in April was chaotic and confusing for many voters. 6 months later, many election officials across the state are changing how they do business, hoping to avoid the same problems in November. But as WPR's Laurel White reports, officials are still facing uncertain circumstances.
Wisconsin's April election happened during a challenging time for the state. The coronavirus pandemic was in its early days. On March 25th, Governor Tony Evers issued his Safer at Home order less than 2 weeks before Election Day.
Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers just made staying at home an official order. All non-essential businesses are set to close their doors and the almost 6
people were trying to figure out how to vote by mail, many for the first time in their lives, and the ballots they requested weren't arriving fast enough. Lawsuits were flying, which led to even more frustration and confusion for voters. Now, 6 months later, election officials are trying to help things go more smoothly. That's why Tom Poppy is standing in a city park pavilion on a recent Saturday afternoon. He's next to a rowdy basketball game and a playground. Poppy is wearing a bright yellow vest with the city clerk's seal on the back. He's a poll worker for the city of Madison, and he's providing a new service for voters.
We're actually allowing them to bring their absentee ballots here that they have already filled out, and they have signed it, and they have a witness.
The event, held on two October weekends, is called Democracy in the Park. Jennifer Bellheimer walked her dog to the park to turn in her ballot.
As much as I like to support USPS, I guess I'd rather just drop it off here with a known, you know, poll worker, and it's in someone's hands.
Wisconsin law allows voters to request their ballot as late as the Thursday before Election Day, with just 5 days to receive, complete, and return it. But the U.S. Postal Service recommends people mail completed ballots at least 1 week before they're due. In Wisconsin, that's 8 p.m. on Election Day. The space between what state law allows and what the Postal Service says is possible is causing some party officials a lot of angst this fall. Party officials like Ben Wickler, the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin.
We just want to say, go, go, go. Let's do this. Let's do this early, and let's get those ballots in.
In April, almost 80,000 ballots arrived at clerk's offices after Election Day. But because a federal court granted a 6-day extension for clerks to receive ballots, they were still counted. Democrats and several advocacy groups have filed a lawsuit to get a similar extension for November's election. So far, they haven't been successful. In general, polling suggests Democrats are more likely than Republicans to vote by mail. Ron Bishop is the chair of the Republican Party at Fond du Lac County.
A lot of people just prefer the traditional show up on Election Day, go to the city hall, get in line and vote.
Bishop took some heat from Republicans for pushing back against President Trump's criticism of mail-in voting. Over the summer, Bishop said his nightmare scenario would be a surge in COVID-19 cases this fall that would scare some GOP voters away from voting in person after they'd already bypassed voting by mail.
It's creepy how that premonition is kind of turning out to be true.
It's true in the sense that COVID cases are surging in Wisconsin. It's impossible to predict who may bypass voting in person on Election Day and why. According to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, more than 1.4 million people have requested mail-in ballots for November. With about a week and a half until Election Day, about 900,000 have been returned. Many communities are now offering ballot drop boxes for people wary of Postal Service delays ahead of Election Day. In-person voting began Tuesday, so many clerks are now offering that option to vote or to register to vote. They have masks, hand sanitizer, a boatload of disposable pens. They all learned hard lessons in April, and they're determined not to repeat history. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.